Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with friend of the program, Dr. Jeffrey Singer, to discuss his new book, Your Body, Your Healthcare. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Singer.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
Dr. Singer, can you show us a copy of the book for the audience who are viewing this?
Sure. It's Your Body, Your Healthcare. The book is published by the Cato Institute. It was released on April 8th of this year. And it's available wherever books are sold, Amazon, it's on Kindle as well, the Cato Institute website, Goodreads, you name it, Barnes & Noble.
And so for those of you who have read Dr. Singer's work on Cato or various other publishing mechanisms, one of the things you'll notice is that you can articulate his voice in the words. And I think that it's a very impactful book that I highly recommend. And for this conversation, I'd like to go over specific aspects of the book because I think it's important to discuss it in detail as it really impacts the general public. So let's, Dr. Singer, begin at the beginning of your book. You talk about in your introduction the infamous Sloandorf case. That is a 1914 legal opinion. And I quote, "Every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body." Talk about why a 1914 case is relevant in this day and age.
Okay, well, that's basically the theme of my book, too. What I've done is I've been at the Cato Institute now for 8 years, and as a practicing surgeon and a senior fellow there in health policy, I've done a lot of work in different areas of healthcare. And what I thought it was important to do was, instead of getting lost in the weeds of policy and numbers and statistics, which we all have a tendency to do discussing this, I wanted to get to the heart of things, the overarching principle, which is we are autonomous adults and we own ourselves. So I put together all of the different subject areas of my book, linking them together by that theme. And I introduced the book to set it up about the story of Mary Sloandorf. And basically, what I point out is that we doctors, from the day we start medical school, have it drilled into us about the ethics of respecting patient autonomy. We're told that you can't do anything, perform a test or any treatment or anything on a person without their fully informed consent. And even if they don't give you their consent, and even after you've made the best argument and you think they're making a terrible mistake by not taking your advice, we have to respect that because they own themselves and are autonomous. That's what we're taught. But I point out that, and probably the younger generation of doctors don't know this, I do, because I'm not the younger generation, but I point out that this is actually a relatively recent development in the medical profession. As recently as the 1970s, doctors were very paternalistic. And the understanding was that doctors know better than the patient what's best for them. And they would routinely withhold information that they didn't think they should know if it was going to get in the way of what they thought was best for them. And they would do things without their consent. So things began to change in the beginning of the 20th century. In New York City, a woman named Mary Sloandorf saw doctors at New York Hospital, and she was the doctor was concerned that she may have a uterine tumor. And in those days, of course, we didn't have MRIs and CTs and that, so it was very common to do what we still do today, but very rarely, an examination under anesthesia, or EUA, because when the person's anesthetized and all their muscles are relaxed, you could get a pretty accurate palpation of their internal organs in their abdomen, and that's the next best thing in the days when we didn't have imaging. So the doctor requested to do an EUA, and she said, but under one condition: if you find something, I don't want you to do anything. I want you to wake me up and tell me what you found, and we'll discuss my options and go from there. So he took her to the operating room, put her under anesthesia, palpated a uterine tumor, went ahead and did a hysterectomy while he was there. It turns out it was a uterine fibroid tumor. She had a whole bunch of complications, but survived, and she was understandably very angry. So she sued, and the case was called Sloandorf versus Society of New York Hospital. The original case was in 1908, and I'm sure law students have learned about this because it was a very important case. So she won on the first round, and then it was appealed by the hospital, and the writing for the majority opinion for the New York State Court of Appeals, then Appeals Court Judge Benjamin Cardozo, who later became a Supreme Court justice, actually one of the more famous ones, he wrote what you just said the opening, which is every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. And he said that in this case, Mary Sloandorf said she did not want any surgery done. She was of sound mind. And what the doctors did was a trespass. That was the word he used. And that was like the first time it was ever kind of stated in case law so eloquently, the principle of autonomy. Now, around that same era, the case actually, that case I'm talking about, that was in 1914. It was started in 08. Around that same time, there were several other cases in different parts of the country, kind of similar stories, but none of them were so eloquently stated as in the Sloandorf case. That's why people go back to that when they're studying medical ethics. But still, it took a long time. Throughout most of the 20th century, of course, we heard of forced sterilizations, live human experiments during the Holocaust, the infamous Tuskegee experiment where doctors were actually not letting men with syphilis know that there was now a treatment for them because they wanted to see how the disease progresses to the end and be able to document it. And, you know, there are example after example. And in fact, a study published in the Journal of Oncology in the 1970s, a survey of oncologists revealed that 60% of oncologists said that they don't tell their patients the entire prognosis of their cancer because they're concerned if they knew that they may not cooperate in what they think is best for them. So that was, and that was in the 70s, okay? I graduated medical school in 1976. So this was around when I was basically, a lot of my teachers were of that mindset. It was starting around the late 70s, early 80s is when this new medical ethics crept in. And by now, like I say, the younger generation of doctors probably be surprised to learn that a generation or two before they weren't thinking this way because they probably assumed this is the way we always think. But so I point out in my book that, okay, so now my profession, after all this time, finally got it. They finally learned to respect autonomy. Unfortunately, there's another entity in the exam room with us and our patients, and that's the government. And the government doesn't respect our autonomy at all. And I kind of give a litany of things. The government tells us, for example, what kind of people we're allowed to get medical advice from, what kind of people we could seek treatment from, what kind of, if people want to open up new centers to give us services, the government may say, no, you don't need that. You have enough. The government tells us what kind of medicines we can take to treat our conditions. And even if it allows us to take a medicine, sometimes it says you'll only be able to take the medicine if you get a permission slip to do so from another autonomous adult like yourself who's licensed by the state as a gatekeeper, sort of, which means a licensed healthcare practitioner. It tells us what kind of substances we can consume into our own body, even if it's not to treat a condition. Maybe it's because we like the way it makes us feel. And it even tells us whether or not we're going to be allowed to take advantage of certain options out there that might reduce the risks of the decisions we make about what to put into our own body and what kind of activities to engage in. So in summary, the government does to us every day what Mary Sloandorf's doctors did to her. And that's my starting off point of the book. And then I have every single chapter. Well, the first chapter deals with explaining first principles. But then the rest of the way, what I do is I take on all of the different areas of outline now. These are areas that I've done a lot of policy work and research papers on already at the Cato Institute. So we talk about medical licensing laws and scope of practice laws, certificate of need laws, the FDA and how it tells us what drugs we're going to be allowed to medicate with, and even whether or not we have to get a permission slip. And the war on drugs and the war on tobacco and the war on harm reduction. So I go on, point by point, and I have to get to a certain degree, I have to get into some of the policy weeds because otherwise I can't make my case. And I also wind up each chapter with proposals as to how to get us back towards autonomy from the ideal to the more politically feasible, so I'm giving options. I'm not being strident. But what I try to do throughout is bring the discussions that we have every day, we hear every day on the news about healthcare policy, back to the what should be the focal point, the fundamental point, which is we're adults and we have autonomy. And whenever we're talking about healthcare policy, we're really having a discussion about what the government is going to do with us or let us do with ourselves.
I think you mentioned later in the book about specific policies as it relates to harm reduction for substances or recreational drugs, and harm reduction as it relates to other aspects of healthcare outside of that realm. And you pointed out some key contradictions. And I want to circle back to that point, because I think it's telling of what you just mentioned, where you articulate certain principles and then you provide policy suggestions. And I think this is something that would resonate quite strongly with many of our viewers. The quotation I like to highlight is, "Policymakers make no efforts to block these forms of harm reduction. They even encourage it. Yet policymakers strike a different chord when it comes to drugs." And in that passage, you highlight the contradiction between GLP-1 medications, seatbelts, and substances that have mind-altering capabilities. Highlight a little bit about, one, yeah, the contradiction, and then two, how that manifests in misguided policies.
Yeah, even when it comes to certain substances, I have a chapter called The War on Some Drugs. For example, the government's position is, if you want to alter your consciousness with a psychoactive substance, let's say to decompress after a stressful day, or just to feel more sociable, to grease the wheels, you can do that with alcohol. But if you use something like cannabis, we're going to put you in a cage and punish you. So there are, getting back to your question, we doctors every day, actually, in modern society, engage in the practice of harm reduction. But unfortunately, people who support drug prohibition have come to hear the word harm reduction and associate it with, it's got baggage. They think you just want to let people use drugs that we don't approve of. And so when I testify before Congress or meet policymakers in Washington, I'm actually advised to try to avoid using the term harm reduction, because a lot of people who support our current drug prohibition recoil when they hear that word. But when you think about it, that's what we do. You know, since in our modern society, people are not dying of infectious diseases like they did 100 years ago, or of accidents related to work and those kind of things. So the great majority of people's health problems have to do with lifestyle choices. So, for example, in the practice of medicine, if we have patients, and I'm sure you see this all the time, you have a patient who, see, if I can get this person to just change their diet regimen and maybe get on an exercise routine and that kind of thing, also change what they eat, I bet you I could get their blood sugar down to a safe level, because right now they're kind of borderline diabetes, and I get their blood pressure under control and they won't need any medication, and I get their cholesterol level down, they won't need any drugs. But for whatever reason, either they don't want to because they enjoy their lifestyle, or they find they just can't comply with it, it's not happening. So when you're prescribing as a doctor a blood pressure pill and, let's say, metformin to get the glucose and the A1C into a better range, and maybe a statin drug to get the cholesterol level down, you're engaging in harm reduction. You're not endorsing their choices. In fact, you know, you probably have tried to get them out of those choices, but you respect their autonomy and you say, okay, well, if I can't get you to change what you're doing, then at least let me do some things for you by prescribing these medications that will make your decisions less risky. So you'll reduce your risk of a heart attack and a stroke, et cetera, et cetera. That's harm reduction. Or when a person's a smoker and they develop COPD from smoking and they end up needing inhaling agents, maybe even stronger things with corticosteroids because they're having trouble breathing. And we've been telling them for years as their doctor, you got to quit smoking. But okay, so now they can't breathe. So we prescribe these things for them because we're doing what we can to reduce the harm. Yet we're not allowed to do that when people insist on using currently illegal drugs, let's say injecting themselves with heroin or fentanyl for whatever reason, either they're addicted or they enjoy it or whatever. But since it's illegal and they have to go to the black market to get it, where it's much more dangerous and where they don't necessarily know what they're purchasing is even what they're told it is and how strong it is. So things like distributing fentanyl test strips to see if it's got fentanyl in it, or clean syringes so you're not spreading HIV and hepatitis, or naloxone so that you could, if you're with someone who overdoses, you could reverse their overdose. Well, that's harm reduction. We're not saying go ahead and shoot up, get high, have a great time. We're saying if you're going to do this, let me do some things for you that will make it less likely that you'll harm yourself. Yet in many states, those kind of things are illegal. And when you suggest allowing organizations that are concerned with this to distribute these things, it's met with resistance from lawmakers. So there's like a double standard. It's okay for you to reduce the harm that when people engage in activities or lifestyle choices that the government says is okay, but not okay for people to reduce, for you to reduce the harm for people engaging in substances that the government doesn't say it's okay. It's almost like you want to see those people die to serve as an example to others. And that's cruel as well as not respecting autonomy.
I cannot agree more. And I think an example you provide in that very section is correlating tobacco, cigarette smoking, and vaping, and kind of highlighting the harm reduction component of one versus the other, but then superimposing a lot of the politicization of that issue as well. And I thought your perspective on that was very interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting too. A lot of the people who are drug warriors who don't want to see legalization or even decriminalization of a lot of the currently illicit drugs, there's such inconsistency, because a lot of those people are the same people who defend, and rightly, e-cigarettes and nicotine replacement techniques for people who are trying to get themselves off of tobacco addiction. And a lot of them, and it's just ironic because it's the same principle. And just for people to know, and I point this out in my book, The majority of people in surveys thinks that it's the nicotine and tobacco smoke that is the killer. But in fact, it's not. The nicotine is relatively harmless. The Royal College of Public Health in the UK says it's essentially the same as caffeine or similar to caffeine. It's a stimulant like caffeine, increases your focus, but also has a calming effect, unlike caffeine. It has possible medicinal uses for PTSD, for ADHD, I mean, not PTSD, for ADHD. It's been shown to actually help schizophrenic patients get their minds more focused. That's why there's such a high rate of smoking among people with schizophrenia, because they've kind of empirically found that when they're smoking, their brain's working a little better. So it's got a lot of positive qualities, but it's addictive. Meanwhile, the part that hurts you is the burning tobacco leaves. So basically, a cigarette is a nicotine delivery system. And we've learned that if we could just, that there are a lot of people who would like to quit smoking and they just need another way to get their nicotine. And so there's nicotine gum, nicotine patches, nicotine pouches now. It seems that evidence, there's a lot of comparative effectiveness research showing that nicotine e-cigarettes or vapes are the most effective means of helping people who want to get off tobacco quit smoking. And I imagine it has something to do with the fact that a lot of the same the people who are addicted to smoking, they have this habit of inhaling and exhaling. Maybe they enjoy that aspect of it. So it kind of more closely resembles the activity of smoking. And that probably is why it works so much better. And it's for that very reason that so many people are against it, particularly people who are for drug decriminalization. It's like a reverse. The people who are for loosening up on tobacco and letting people use e-cigarettes are not for loosening up on cannabis and other illicit drugs, and then vice versa. And the fact is, we just need to be consistent. And if you look at nicotine replacement treatment as a form of harm reduction, because it's getting people off of tobacco smoke. And then even if you're not a smoker, there's some people who just like the feeling they get from nicotine. And if you can get your nicotine in a safe, form, such as nicotine pouch, like we're hearing about, you know, Zyn and other brands like that, or nicotine e-cigarette, then what's wrong with that? I mean, I'm a caffeine addict. I can't even get my day started without having a half a pot of coffee. That's my version to get me going. Nobody wants to put me in jail for that.
No, well said. I want to transition maybe a little earlier in the book where you talk about the FDA, but I can't resist by just ending this segment by dropping another quotation that I thought was kind of matching your wit to a certain degree. The optimal harm reduction strategy is to end drug prohibition. And I thought that was really interesting. Transitioning to talk about pharmacovigilance, which I thought was an interesting term that you dropped, and the FDA. You give an example of the drug thalidomide, and you talk about kind of the Byzantine layering of the FDA as a result of that, and then go on to talk about some of the issues that have created problems within the FDA as a result of that. Can you maybe guide us as you articulate this in this book? Talk about the thalidomide issue, talk about what the FDA morphed into, and what has led to the current problem.
Sure. Yeah, I have two chapters in the book that deal with the FDA. A lot of people can't imagine what it would be like if we didn't have an FDA, but the FDA, as we know it, didn't really exist until 1938. So up until then, the Pure Food and Drug Act said that anybody selling a drug, we reserve the right, the government, to randomly test it, and it better have in it what you say it has in it. And if you have anything in there that could be potentially harmful or addictive, like alcohol or opium, you need to put that on a label. That was the only law. And the government set up the Federal Bureau of Chemistry to do the testing. So you could argue, okay, that's a truth in labeling kind of act. And it's preventing companies from defrauding people or, you know, withholding valuable information. So, you know, that's fine. But now, fast forward to 1938, and I get into the whole reason behind it, but after a number of people, the first antibiotic, sulfanilamide, was developed. And a company in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, called Massengill, developed an elixir form because it was only in a pill form and an intravenous form, so for children. And it turns out that they used a solvent, diethylene glycol, which is it's antifreeze, and it was a poison. They didn't know at the time. There were about close to 100 deaths. Interestingly, almost everyone who was given the sulfanilamide was prescribed it by their doctor. And mothers, I talk about it in the book, mothers would call a doctor saying, my little girl is getting worse. And the doctor said, okay, give her some more, double up on it. And because they're being poisoned. So anyway, as a result, the chemist who developed it actually committed suicide. The company was sued and went bankrupt. And kind of the system took care of itself between tort laws and everything else. But, politicians always swing into action, usually after the problem's already kind of settled down and taken care of itself. So they passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act in 1938. And they said, okay, from this point forward, no new drug can come to market unless we're persuaded that it's safe and you have to show us your data. So anything already on the market is grandfathered, which included aspirin and two forms of insulin, the old school regular and NPH insulin, which to this day, because of that, you can get over the counter. If you go to Walmart Pharmacy, I think the brand they use is called Relion, R-E-L-I-O-N. Now, when I was a resident, that's the only insulin we had. It's not convenient. You got to test yourself frequently and sometimes administer it more than once a day, but it's there still and it's very cheap. Anyway, so that started things. But even then, when the law was passed, in the transcript, you can see the author of the law said, nothing in this law is intended to interfere with people's rights to self-medicate. So they were still giving a nod to autonomy. And they said, we just want to assure that when they self-medicate, it's safer. It also said that up until then, it was up to the pharmaceutical company to decide whether they wanted to market their product prescription only or over the counter. It was a decision they would make with their legal team. You know, they may as drugs got more complex like they are today, you probably see most drugs, new ones, be prescription only. But the legal team would say, look, this is complicated. If somebody doesn't use it the way we spelled out on the label, something bad's going to happen. We're going to get sued. We're going to maybe lose our business. So we should insist that if the pharmacist dispenses this, they have to have a prescription from a healthcare practitioner. That'll cover us because the healthcare practitioner is now responsible. So that's how it was done. Then in 1951, and I don't want to spend too much time explaining how it happened, but Congress added the Durham-Humphrey Amendment to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and said, okay, from this point forward, we're not leaving it up to the pharmaceutical companies. The government's going to decide what's prescription only and what's over the counter. And then in 1962, they made it even more complicated because of thalidomide. So thalidomide is a drug that was developed to treat nausea of pregnancy or morning sickness. Actually, it's a very effective anti-nausea medicine. Just don't take it when you're pregnant. That's the only problem. So it hadn't yet been approved by the FDA, but it was approved in Europe. And doctors here had samples that the drug maker was making available to them. And again, this is before they respected autonomy. So I'm sure the doctors weren't saying to their patients, look, this hasn't been approved yet, but it looks promising, and I have some samples. You want to try it. Instead, they probably just said, here, try this. Because if the patient had a informed consent, they may have said, well, is this safe for me to take? And if the doctor said, I'm not sure, they may have said, nah, I think I'll pass. I got to, you know, I'm pregnant and I want to. So there were a lot of horrendous birth defects, mostly in Europe, but a couple here. And so Congress added the Kefauver-Harris Amendments in 1962 to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And this said, okay, from this point on, you not only have to prove that it's safe, but you have to prove that it's efficacious, efficacy. And that still to this day puzzles me because I'm thinking, well, thalidomide was efficacious. It worked great for nausea. Just don't take it when you're pregnant. You could take it otherwise. So it wasn't an efficacy question, but that added years on to the drug approval process and millions of dollars so that by the time the drug would come out, you know, there were not that many years left on the patent. And the patent, of course, granted the manufacturer a monopoly so they could use that monopoly to kind of charge higher, recoup some of their sunken research and development costs before the generics come and compete with them. But also, more importantly, that would add many more years before patients had access to it. So to this day, there are drugs that are available in other countries that haven't yet been approved here. And as autonomous adults with the right to self-medicate, which is a corollary of autonomy, we're being denied, our rights are being infringed on when the FDA is saying, we're not ready to let you have it. Yeah, but they let them have it in the UK. Well, we haven't decided that you could have it. That's what's going on. So that's related to the thalidomide thing. The other interesting thing is that when a drug is approved after passing all those efficacy tests, it's approved for whatever the drug company had put in the application, what was aimed to treat. So that goes on a label. So let's say your drug is an antibiotic aimed to treat streptococcal infections. So that's what goes on a label. But as far as the FDA is concerned, you as a doctor, you know, if you go to meetings and read in medical journals that this drug, based on the way it works and its chemical makeup, this could also be helpful to treat another condition, you're welcome to do that. That's called off-label because it doesn't say it on the label. And 20% of all drugs prescribed in this country are for off-label uses. So you may ask, well, wait, so you made me wait all this extra time for you to approve, you allow me as a doctor to prescribe this drug for condition A. But as far as you're concerned, FDA, for conditions B through Z, you'll just defer to my expertise as a doctor? Well, why didn't you defer to my expertise for condition A as well? I mean, so again, I have like problems with the logic of it, but that's the system we have today.
It's very interesting in how you highlight how pervasive off-labeling is when it comes to medications and how the FDA almost serves as you had mentioned, these gatekeepers. And there's a term that you use where you talk about the pharmacovigilance, and then later you talk about this concept of permission slips to compete. And yeah, so I saw parallels between how the FDA almost issues these permission slips to say, hey, now you're able to go onto the market. But once they get into the market, it becomes free reign, where then drugs can be used at the physician's discretion. Yet other policies like certificates of need is almost the other way around. So there's these kind of wonky policies and how the regulatory agencies either give permission or restrict permission, but then how it's intended to be used. Maybe for the listening audience that's not familiar with CONs and how you articulate in the book, provide some context about that. And then sure, I would love to kind of, as you juxtapose the certificates of need, these permission slips, guide into how you then talk about the FDA, because I think that was a really interesting part of the book.
Okay. Well, for those who may not be aware of certificate of need laws, I start my chapter by giving an example. Suppose there was a certificate of need commission for restaurants in your state. And, you know, I have this great new concept, a fusion of Indian and Mexican cuisine. And I got a chef who could mix these, you know, cuisine techniques together. And I have a great idea for a restaurant, but I can't open it unless the certificate of need commission says it's okay. And the commission is made up of the existing restaurant owners, particularly the ones who own the big chains. And I put in my application, I explain what my idea is, and they say, nah, you know, I don't think we need a restaurant like that. We have enough restaurants that are kind of, you know, interesting, creative cuisines. There's no need for it. So denied. That sounds absurd, right? Well, that in 35 states, that's the way it is when it comes to healthcare facilities. And it all started back in the Nixon years, after Medicaid and Medicare kind of geared up, all of a sudden healthcare expenditures started really going up. And some policymakers came up with this idea that if we restrict the number of healthcare services that people can offer, then maybe we'll get people to use it less. So it's like a reversal of the law of supply and demand. You know, if we reduce supply, we'll reduce demand somehow. Okay. So the Congress passed this act in the 1970s, and they gave grants to different states for setting up certificate of need commissions, which mainly consisted of the commissions consisted of like representatives from the hospitals and the clinics in the state. And by what they didn't take into account was that with a third party payer system we have, most people are not really affected too much by price because that's picked up by the insurance company. So even if there is a high demand and a restricted supply, which would raise the price, as far as the patient is concerned, the insurance company is paying for it, not the patient. So it's not influencing the patient's behavior to use less. So by the mid-1980s, it became very obvious it wasn't working. And Congress repealed it, which is unusual because they rarely ever say we made a mistake, let's cancel this. That's maybe one of the few times in modern history. So they repealed it. But by that time, a lot of the what we call incumbents, the, you know, the big hospital chains, et cetera, they kind of like this. So even though the states stopped getting grants to set it up, efforts for the states to remove these certificate of need commissions were fought tooth and nail by the incumbents. Now, about 15 states did. My state of Arizona did in 1990, same time that California did. But about 35 states still have that in place. And they're pretty transparent about it, actually. I testified remotely before the Kentucky legislature. They have among the most certificate of need for different categories, you know, nursing homes, ambulance services, outpatient surgery centers. If you want to add a wing onto your hospital, add some more beds, maybe buy a new MRI machine, all these things require permission. So I testified about repealing it. And the representative of the hospital association actually said, look, in some of the rural areas of our state, the great majority of our patients are Medicaid patients, and they don't pay us very much. If we had competitors come in with, you know, ambulatory surgery centers to compete with our hospital surgery centers, we wouldn't make enough money to stay in business. And that's why we need to keep this in place. And my response to that was, you know, I'm sure the Kentucky physicians in the rural areas also have a majority of Medicaid patients. But if the Kentucky Medical Association said here today, we shouldn't allow any new doctors in the state of Kentucky until we doctors who are here in Kentucky get to decide if we need another one in that part of town. You would dismiss that as absurd, yet it's okay for the hospitals to do this. Well, I lost in the argument, so it's still the way it is in Kentucky. But yeah, in 35 states, we have that. Now, getting back to permission slips with the FDA, if we didn't have right now the FDA has a monopoly on deciding what's prescription only and what's over the counter, which began after 1951. But when the government has a monopoly, it's, you know, they're not angels. We're all humans. So it's this monopoly is subjected to political pressures, to special interest pleading, which is why, for example, I'll give you a couple examples. In the United States, to this day, birth control, women can't get birth control pills over the counter, but they can get it over the counter in 100 countries. And the American College of OBGYNs, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the AMA for 20 years have been saying, you shouldn't need to come to me, take time off of work, get billed for an office visit, get an exam. You don't need any of this. You should be able to get this over the counter, except, you know, in certain unique circumstances where I would recommend an exam or something. But you should be able to get it over the counter. It doesn't matter what they say. The government has decided that's not the case. Or in 1999, when the FDA approved the so-called morning after pill, emergency contraceptive, Plan B was the famous name, famous brand. It had already been available in Europe. It took up until the year 2013 and a court order for it to be available over the counter to women of all ages. Even after the FDA approved it over the counter for women of all ages, I think in 2012, the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time, Catherine Sebelius, in the Obama administration, overruled the FDA. Obviously, for political reasons, maybe social conservatives were concerned about sexual promiscuity. I don't know what the reasons were, but it took a judge, 14 years and a judge, for people to be able to get access to that drug because you had a monopoly. If we didn't have that, we'd have it the way it was before, where private pharmaceutical companies concerned about liability risks, concerned about reputation and competition, they would make these decisions on a case-by-case basis. And now most of the more complicated medicines probably would still be prescription only, but they're on the margin. Things like birth control pills and morning after pill and naloxone and things like that wouldn't be prescription only. They'd be over the counter. There's a whole GLP-1s, for example. I've written articles arguing that they should be over the counter. So, but it's up to the government to make the decision. Also, people can't imagine how will we check for safety of these drugs. Well, before the FDA was created, there were several private entities that would vet all these drugs. The U.S. Pharmacopoeia, which still exists to this day and is the largest compendium of all medications, they played a very large role. But the American Medical Association had set up the Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry. And they said to all of the pharmaceutical companies, if you want us to designate you as an ethical pharmaceutical company, then you have to submit your drugs to us for testing. And if you don't, then we're going to not label you as an ethical pharmaceutical company, and we're not going to allow you to advertise in any of our numerous medical journals, which is going to make it much more difficult for you to get the information to doctors as to what your medicine is. So the great majority, particularly the big ones like Pfizer and Merck, they wanted to be deemed ethical, and they cooperated. So these are just a couple of organizations. It's not like you know, it's going to be the Wild Wild West. Any one of us, when we buy food in a grocery store or buy a car or a computer or whatever, we need information. We don't know. And if I knew enough about what goes into making a computer, then, you know, I don't know a lot about it, but I do rely on, you know, reviewing services, et cetera. And so the needs are going to be met by independent third party actors who are competing with each other, too, for quality and for reputation. So they don't want to be wrong, because then they'll lose out to their competitors. So these existed before. They were actually, the AMA closed up the Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry in 1955 because basically the FDA made them superfluous. Yeah.
Amazing read and amazing insights. In the remaining time that we have, I would like to talk about the last few passages in the conclusion of the book. You end by talking about the white coat ceremonies, and you talk about the Hippocratic Oath. One last line that I thought was very important was, regrettably, government has stepped in, usually with good intentions, in ways that ignore or violate patient autonomy. And so in the last words of the book, what sort of lingering message did you want to give the readers as they walk away?
So that final chapter is called The Schloendorf Legacy. I try to bring it back to the introduction. And I point out, probably everybody's aware in the last couple of years, there have been some very controversial versions of the Hippocratic Oath or the white coat ceremony at numerous medical schools. The Hippocratic Oath has been taken at medical schools in the Western world since the late 1800s. And there have been different iterations from the original one of Hippocrates to more modern versions. But in recent years, a lot of schools have allowed the students and faculty to make their own oath. And a lot of them have digressed from anything that has to do with medicine. They deal with things that have upset, it becomes kind of culture war issues, dealing with things like social justice, and many older doctors and many lay people are saying, well, there's nothing in here about even taking care of patients. So rather than get into that dispute, I give some examples. I say, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's these modern oaths or the one that I took back when I was in medical school or the one that Hippocrates had his disciples take. None of them really, they say I will do no harm, but they never say anything about respecting their patient's autonomy. That's left out. So I proposed, by this point now, of course, I've covered all these different areas in the book, and based on that, I say, here's what I propose. Here's my idea of what a Hippocratic Oath should be, and I composed a Hippocratic Oath that puts autonomy first and views us doctors as basically consultants to our patients. In fact, the better word, I think, for patients should be clients, because we should approach our patients the way our attorneys approach us as clients, the way our accountants approach us as clients. These are grown-ups. They make the final call. They're asking us for our best advice, and we're ethically obligated to give them our best advice, but then it's their call. So I compose an oath like that. And if there's any takeaway, like I say, I'm a libertarian, as you know, and the Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank. So I'm kind of giving a libertarian overview of health policy. I'm bringing it to basic, fundamental, classical, liberal, philosophical principles, because we lose sight of that so often when we're discussing these individual particulars and being more concerned about consequentialism rather than morals. So I bring it back to that, and so some of my suggestions in the book might strike readers who had not thought about it from this angle before as a little startling. They may, the idea of getting rid of the FDA, of getting rid of licensing, that may come across as you know, they may be intrigued and never thought about it like that before, but some of my ideas might come across as a little too much for them to go along with. And I'm fine with that. My goal with this book is, if by the time you're done reading this book, suddenly from this point forward, when you're hearing debates in the public square about, you know, health policy, drug policy, how to treat people with pain or whatever, you realize that at the end of the day, this is really about lawmakers discussing how the government is going to interfere with my autonomy as an adult and my right to make my own personal health care decisions and the fact that I own myself. And if I have readers appreciate that, they may have different solutions than I suggest, but I want them to appreciate that, and that's what I'm aiming for.
Thank you so much, Dr. Singer. It was an amazing conversation. I really enjoyed reading your book and learning more about your insights. For those who are listening and made it this far, thank you. The book, again, is Your Body, Your Healthcare. And Dr. Singer, if you could just show a title of the book. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.